Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
It is a great pleasure to welcome to the program Jim Frederick, one of the leading people at Time Magazine and Time Incorporated, who is the author of a book that Time brought out only about 5 or 6 weeks ago, titled Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors. How many of them are there?
Special Operations Forces?
Yeah.
Well, within what we can generally think of as the Black Ops Forces, which is SEAL Team 6, Delta Force, the 24th Special Tactics Squadron of the Air Force, there's about 4,000 or so, approximately. Nobody's really sure exactly how many there are, but there's about 4,000 of what we think of as the most elite of the elite Special Operations Forces. If you extend the definition to include U.S. Army Rangers, Special Forces operation, Special Forces soldiers that we call the Green Berets, and other SEAL teams, not SEAL Team 6, but there's up to a dozen other SEAL teams under Naval Special Operations Command, you're up to about 60 or 70,000 soldiers.
That many.
Yeah.
You have a brief section in this very interesting book, which also is splendidly illustrated. One would expect nothing less from Time Magazine, but there's an awful lot of very good readable content here. I've learned a great deal from it. And you have a section in here about historical background. I wish it were a little bit longer because it's so fascinating. You date the beginning of Special Ops to the Spartans at Thermopylae.
Yeah. Special Operations obviously has a very loose definition over time. And so we went back and we tried to figure out what could be defined as a Special Operations force. And not to be too obvious about it, but the idea was that they had to be special. And the specialness usually involves either size. They're usually small units, and the Spartans at Thermopylae, you know, were only 300. They're specially trained. They're trained in ways that are the way that the modes of warfare fought at that time. They're unconventional forces, which among the Greek city-states, Spartans definitely were. Very often they operate behind enemy lines, or they are involved in elements of surprise or attacks that are unconventional or designed to overthrow much larger units. And so,
well, they were there to confront a much larger unit,
right,
the Persian army.
Right.
And they got into this narrow pass at Thermopylae, surrounded by mountains, and they held the pass,
right,
knowing, but this was sacrificial,
right,
knowing they would all be killed, but holding them back for as long as possible.
Right. And there was also an element of, you know, or go down dying to many special forces operations. And so that was really the first unit that we pinpointed that filled a lot of the definitions.
And then jumping forward only about 200 years, we get the father of Hannibal, namely Hamilcar Barca,
right,
or Carthaginian general. What was he up to?
Well, he was into the tactics of unconventional warfare, of harassing attacks and doing the unexpected. And so he met our definition because he could be counted on to do whatever the Romans did not expect him to do, which we definitely consider a special ops characteristic that is helpful.
Well, he harried them from behind their lines and in quick darts, quick attacks with only 50 or 60 men.
Right, flanking.
Killing
maneuvers
where he could, but then getting out.
Yeah, and then darting out, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's a tactic still used to this day, of course.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And then, you know, forwarding even further in the American context of what a special operations force, a lot of it dates all the way to revolutionary times and many of the tactics that were learned from,
or back to the French and Indian War. You mentioned Rogers Rangers.
Right, and Native American tactics, and things that we now consider to be guerrilla warfare, camouflage, and lying in wait, and certain styles of ambush.
It sort of dropped like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Right, yeah. They definitely picked up from, even the very definition of the word ranger was from colonial and French Indian War times when, you know, horsebacked riders would literally ride the open ranges from fort to fort.
And going forward to our Civil War, there's Mosby's Rangers. Who were they? What did they do?
Mosby's Rangers also operated behind enemy lines.
They're a Confederate force.
They were Confederate forces that harried the Union forces behind enemy lines. They they brought modern sniping into prominence. They were very good shots, and they could bring a man down from, you know, hundreds of yards away.
And then I must tell you, one night, rather early in my career as a talk show host, I had as my guest Bill Colby, who for a while ran the CIA.
Oh, okay.
But goes way back, of course, before that to OSS during World War II.
Right.
And as we were chatting and went to the phones, a caller called in and said, Bill, I was in Jedburgh. And Colby blew up with enthusiasm.
Uh-huh.
A friend had called. He didn't know this man, but he was also trained in Jedburgh, an operation of OSS,
right.
a behind-the-lines kind right. of guerrilla operation back in World War II.
Yeah, and obviously spying has been a part of warfare since the beginning of time, but I think what the OSS brought to what we currently think of as our unconventional forces is the use of cryptography, disguises, passing as civilians, and that was really their major contribution to the
modern... The Jedburghs went in and did all that, but they also did guerrilla attacks behind the lines.
Sure, there's definitely a military aspect to it and a violence and warfare aspect to it as well, no question.
But there's a basic division right there between intelligence operations and also concealment operations and fooling the enemy with
right.
False messages and so on. Well, that's all on one side. On the other side is actual assault.
Yeah, and yeah. You'll see that line is blurry in modern mm-hmm. day, that obviously SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force specialize in very aggressive, very militaristic, you know, lethal action, but they're also they'll blow down a door when they need to, or they'll pick the lock when they need to. They're very adept at, you know, you've heard all through the Afghan and Iraq wars that special operations forces are allowed to wear facial hair in a manner that most conventional army soldiers are not, because they never know when they might be required to fly in civilian clothing to, say, Cairo and, you know, conduct some operations among a civilian population where they're really riding the line into espionage and things that we can...
Beards go well in the Islamic world.
Well, yeah, and long hair, even among, yeah. you know, Western societies, that the buzz cut that you traditionally associate with a U.S. Army soldier, for most special operations forces, they definitely wear mm-hmm. their hair in a more civilian-type manner.
I started with the pre-introduction tonight with a reference, of course, to the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Mm.
That was SEAL Team 6.
That was SEAL Team 6.
And fascinating operation, obviously, about which we still don't know all that ultimately we will probably know. I'm about to pause for some necessary commercials. After that, everything you could tell us about the way in which we got Osama bin Laden and also the consequences of our killing him. We return directly to Jim Frederick, author of Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors, after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with Jim Frederick, author of the new book, Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors. And here's a sound clip for you, Jim, and for our listeners. The date, May 2nd, 2011.
A cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic...
How we got Billie Holiday, when I'm looking for a clip having to do with a shooting of Osama bin Laden, I do not understand. Will the gentleman in the booth please let me know whether you've got the proper clip? I need some information. We do not have the proper clip? Apparently it is the wrong disc. Where the right disc is, I don't know. Well, that's an embarrassment. But you run Time Magazine, so you know all about yeah. things going wrong.
It happens sometimes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about it all the same.
Okay.
How did they do it?
Well, obviously it was about 10 years in the making, and all of the United States intelligence community had been looking for Osama bin Laden for about 10 years, and they had identified several persons who had been couriers, associates, but there were probably dozens and dozens of such people. One of them happened to keep traveling back and forth to this house in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Abbottabad, Pakistan is about an hour as the crow flies from the capital. It is a very wealthy town. It's almost a commuter suburb, if you could call it that. It's the home of a Pakistan military academy and several brigades of Pakistan military, doctors, lawyers, retired army officers live there. So it's a nice place. And this courier kept going there several times a year. And so this is attracted the attention of the CIA and certain members of the intelligence community, and they pinpointed this house that this courier kept going back and forth to. And there's some things that were very interesting about this house, that they didn't take out their trash the way that most houses in this city did. They burned all their trash. They had no internet or satellite access whatsoever, which in a town like this would be exceedingly rare. And anybody who lived at the house would get into a car and drive for at least an hour and a half before they would even put the batteries into their cell phones to make a phone call. There were no communications whatsoever in this house. So those things are all extremely particularly bizarre. Like, there's people there that don't want to make any footprint whatsoever. And the CIA set up a surveillance post in that town. And sure enough, within a couple of days or several months, they identified, you know, a 6'3", 6'4" man. And Osama bin Laden is known to be very tall, who would take a walk in the courtyard, would never leave the compound, but would take a walk in the courtyard every day for an hour or two. And the CIA dubbed this man the Pacer. And through various checks and balances systems, they got to a high degree of likelihood that they thought that this was who the... They thought that they found their man. They thought that this was Osama bin Laden. So
this is a case of hiding in plain sight, in a way, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And to this day, there's some questions.
Who would ever think that you'd go to the West Point of Pakistan?
The West Point of Pakistan.
To find Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, and you know, you made reference to some of the problems that the killing of Osama bin Laden has engendered to this day, is our relations with the Pakistanis are still strained because there's significant members of the American military and intelligence community.
What do our intelligence people say, if only to one another, about whether the Pakistan government was complicit in this whole operation? That complicit in the hiding of Osama bin Laden?
I think that the opinions vary, and I think that there are different elements within the Pakistani government, that there is a division of the Pakistani government called the ISI, which is basically
that's military intelligence,
which is their intelligence service,
yeah.
Which is well known. I mean, it's an open secret that they give aid and comfort and intelligence to the Taliban, that they see the Taliban as an instrumental organization in destabilizing Afghanistan, because in their opinion, a destabilized Afghanistan is good for Pakistan.
Help to the Taliban and also to Al-Qaeda at its height.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. To Al-Qaeda. I mean, it's there's significant members of the U.S. intelligence community that don't even pretend that this is not the case. I mean, it
but we still share intelligence with Pakistani military intelligence.
I
would guess
we do, and we don't. We certainly did not tell them about this particular this particular operation. And there were debates within the U.S. government about whether or not Pakistan should be informed that this was happening.
We have now recovered the proper recording of the announcement to the country. This is John King at CNN that night.
Several sources now that the President of the United States will announce in just moments that the United States has the body of Osama bin Laden, that Osama bin Laden has been killed, and that the United States is convinced that it has the body of Osama bin Laden, the mastermind of 9/11, the architect of Al-Qaeda. We don't know the details. We don't know how this came about, but we are told now by several sources, administration sources and congressional sources, that the administration is now telling senior members of Congress and telling others that it believes it now has, it is convinced it now has, the body of Osama bin Laden. He has been killed. We don't know the details of how that happened, but that is the dramatic announcement the president will make. And Don, just think of what this means.
Yeah.
Almost 10 years since the 9/11 attacks. More than that, since Osama bin Laden has been the head of Al-Qaeda. The president of the United States is to walk into the briefing room on a Sunday night and tell the nation that after all this waiting, all this heartache, all this search, all this failure, that the United States government is now convinced that it has the body of Osama bin Laden, and Osama bin Laden is dead almost 10 years after the 9/11 attack. And Wolf Blitzer, we covered the White House for a long time together. You know just what this means. You know what a figure Osama bin Laden has become, a nefarious figure around the world, not just the United States. The President of the United States, Barack Obama, about to walk into the United States briefing room and say that the United States is now certain Osama bin Laden has been killed.
A moment of great victory, I suppose. Whether it's a victory that ultimately makes all that much difference, one still doesn't know.
Mm.
Al-Qaeda's still there.
Yes.
And Islamic radical assault upon the West continues.
It does continue, although I think al-Qaeda has been significantly weakened over the past decade, not to the point that they're not a threat. They certainly are. But
now, what do we learn examining the operation itself? How typical is it of our special ops forces at their most competent?
Well, the thing that's I find most interesting about this particular mission that's garnered so much attention is how routine it was. They weren't really doing much different than they do literally, not to exaggerate, across the world when Iraq and Afghanistan were at their hottest, a dozen or more times a night. Definitely.
A dozen or more times a night?
Night raids were...
To kill whom?
Well, most night raids are non-lethal. I think the estimate is that about 80% of them result in arrests rather than killings, takedowns rather than actual killings. But it was, for a long time, the preferred method of special operations forces was the night raid to identify a high-value target to go in to wherever they were, whether it was a house or other locale, and detain, arrest them, and you know, take them back to be interrogated or detained.
And during all those active years in Iraq, we were doing that every night?
Absolutely.
Going after what sorts of people then?
Sunni insurgents, actual al-Qaeda, Shiite insurgents, the Mahdi army, the Islamic army of Iraq.
Just about everybody was the enemy.
Well, there were quite a few and still are. So really the only thing that was particularly remarkable about this raid was who the target was and the fact that it was in Pakistani soil and that we were violating another country's sovereign airspace, which does happen. But this was a big one because Pakistan is, you know, an ally and would have liked to have been notified about such things.
So how did they sneak in under a radar cover?
Well, apparently Pakistan's radar defense system is not as good as they would have liked. But they flew in on two heavily modified MH-60 Black Hawk helicopters, probably the most state-of-the-art, sound dampening, heat dampening. There appears to be some kind of modified rotor that the Blackhawks were using because one of the Blackhawks did crash land during the mission and had to be blown up in place, but pieces did survive. And so, you know, foreign intelligence services, you know, domestic journalists like myself and certainly most of the blogger community, you know, really enjoyed trying to figure out what was going on with that back rotor, which appeared to be some sort of sound dampening technology. So they flew in on two Black Hawk helicopters, and then it was a pretty routine mission to breach a house.
They're in that building for only about 34, 35 minutes.
Yeah, 38 minutes, I think I wrote. Yeah.
They blow the door to get in?
They did. Well, there was a front courtyard door that they definitely blew open.
And there are some people visible immediately, and they killed them.
Yeah, one of the couriers either did or did not have a weapon, but he was killed on site. Then there was another driver, handler, and his wife who were both killed. The mm-hmm. woman, you know, the United States government is very upfront about the fact that the woman was definitely not armed, but they killed her. One of Osama bin Laden's sons was on site, and he was armed. And as they went up the staircases, they killed him. And then on the top floor of a three-story house, they found Osama bin Laden, and they killed him with, I believe, two shots.
There were never any orders to take him alive if possible.
I believe the standing order, what has been reported back to the press, was that unless he showed signs of conspicuous and immediate surrender, that if he showed anything, you know, any evacuation, any fleeing, and anything, any hostile disposition, that he was to be killed. The report back was that whatever he did not demonstrate signs of immediate and unquestioned surrender.
But apparently he was not armed.
I believe he was not armed.
And was there anything to the story that we had at one point that he had a wife with him and we put in front of him?
Well, who knows? That there were two of his wives or two women in that room. Whether or not he pushed one of the women in front of him or the SEALs body tackled one of the women, I'm not sure we're ever going to know. I mean, just the granular details to that level, whether that itself is propaganda.
There were two of his wives with him in that room
floor. Yeah.
Were they killed?
I can't recall at the moment. I don't know.
I think at least one of them was taken
away. I think one was killed, and I think one was injured.
Yeah. rather exciting.
Yeah, and so the only body that they took back was the body of Osama bin Laden, yeah, in order to identify and verify that it actually was him.
They buried him at sea.
And they buried him at sea, and they got a lot of hard drives and computers and intelligence. But yeah, it was 38 minutes on the ground, undetected, about several hours in and out. Textbook mission. They lost a helicopter.
A curious question that one might raise is, why did it take so long to locate him?
Well, that's
the million.
He'd
been in that house for 6 or 7 years, apparently.
He had been there a long time, yeah. That's the million-dollar question. I couldn't even begin to tell you, and I'm God knows how many billions of dollars and how many man-hours were spent trying to find him.
Still, it worked out much better than what happened a number of years before in Tehran.
Yes.
And we want to turn to that. We're about to pause for an update on the news, and then back to a less fortunate president, Jimmy Carter, and his handling and the special ops failure to free the hostages from our embassy in Tehran. As we return to Jim Frederick, right after the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Jim Frederick. We're drawing from his fine new book, Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors. That's a special project of Time, Time Magazine, of which Jim Frederick is one of the senior editors. You've just been promoted to, or at least shifted to, being editor of the International Edition. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we publish, in addition to our U.S. edition, we publish an Asian edition and a European edition, and I'm the editor of those editions.
So you've got hard duty. You got to run to Hong Kong and London every so often.
I do. Every couple of weeks, I have to go to one or the other place. Uh-huh.
That's not as strenuous a job as being a special ops person, is it?
No, definitely not. Something to be thankful for.
I imagine the food is better, too. So how do they maintain these guys when they're not out there capturing and killing?
Well, it's a highly disciplined regimen. I mean, these guys are at peak physical performance, peak technical performance as well. I think that they have some of the most rigorous acceptance programs, qualifications programs known to any military. And then once they get into one of these special operations units, the training tempo and the operation tempo is really quite punishing. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we had a couple of people that we interviewed who were either former Delta Force or SEAL Team 6. And, you know, they said with the wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was not uncommon for them to be away, not just on call, but away from home 250, 260 days a year, every year, year after year after year. And so what we found was there's a lot of burnout for these guys, that they can only do it so many years before. I don't think we've really come to terms with the psychological impact that this kind of operations tempo has on them. But what usually breaks down in their minds first is their bodies. You know, just a knee or a shoulder or something goes. And, you know, whereas a military career can easily last, you know, 30, 35 years, I think to be in one of these top, top units, to be at your peak physical and mental conditioning, you know, they really only stay in the top tier units for 8 or 10 years. It's kind of like being a professional athlete, actually.
The Green Berets used to strut around wearing their Green Berets and telling you stories about their operations in Vietnam. But then they put a kind of a hold on all of this. They didn't want these special ops people talking about what they were doing.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting things about the culture that has changed is, yeah, you go back and you look at the way that the Green Berets, which was really America's first special operations unit, behaved during the Vietnam War. And yeah, they would wear tiger skin capes and crocodile boots, and they were very flamboyant, you know, to use your word. I think the movie, The Green Berets, the John Wayne movie, came out, and that was really bad, actually, for the Green Berets. Although it was a very patriotic movie, it was kind of cheesy and heavy-handed and ham-fisted, and there started to be a kind of backlash, and so the entire community retrenched. And the order of the day now is absolutely positively understated excellence. If somebody never knows that you're an operator for your, that's what most high level special operations forces call a soldier is an operator. Mm-hmm. if you go your whole career and nobody ever in the civilian world knows that you're an operator, no, if your next door neighbor doesn't know that you're in Delta Force, that's just fine with them. They've gone an almost 180 that they now pursue a policy of almost complete glory avoidance. And
but I'm sure that the that journalists have been trying to find actual members of the SEAL Team 6 group that killed Osama bin Laden. I don't think any one of them has surfaced yet, have they?
No. I mean, at the time, we absolutely did. We went looking for them.
You went looking
for them. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they don't – we couldn't come anywhere near them. We couldn't find them, you know, either using back channels or official channels. Admiral William McRaven, who's the head of all Special Operations Command. I mean, he was perfectly content to sit down for an interview with Time for a Person of the Year issue. But yeah, the question of going anywhere near these guys was out of the question. And we even, when we were going through official channels, we said, you know, if it's a security issue, if any of their names or faces become public, you know, we're happy to obscure that. Or we had scenarios where we'll just take photos, you know, we'll have McRaven stand in front of them and their backs will be turned. But it has to be them, you know, for journalistic integrity reasons. And, you know, they didn't even want to do that because, you know, I think at least, I don't know about other journalists, but, you know, Time had no interest in putting these men's lives at risk. But it's not just the actual team that killed Osama bin Laden. We have trouble finding anybody who is a veteran of these top-tier units who wants to talk to the press for any reason.
You haven't been able to interview any members of Delta Force or SEAL Team 6?
No, we found some. We found some, but they're not as easy to find as your average, you know, member of a conventional
In the background unit. Of all of this is an older story, which really has some very sad angles to it. It has to do with the hostage crisis in Tehran.
Right.
Here is President Jimmy Carter telling the country about our special problem.
We continue to face a grave situation in Iran, where our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages in an attempt to force unacceptable demands on our country. We're using every available channel to protect the safety of the hostages and to secure their release. Along with the families of the hostages, I have welcomed and I appreciate the restraint that has been shown by Americans during this crisis. We must continue to exhibit such constraint. Despite the intensity of our emotions, the lives of our people in Iran are at stake. I must emphasize the gravity of the situation. It's vital to the United States and to every other nation that the lives of diplomatic personnel and other citizens abroad be protected, and that we refuse to permit the use of terrorism and the seizure and the holding of hostages to impose political demands. No one should underestimate the resolve of the American government and the American people in this matter. It is necessary to eliminate any suggestion that economic pressures can weaken our stand on basic issues of principle. Our position must be clear. I am ordering that we discontinue purchasing of any oil from Iran for delivery to this country.
Meanwhile, there was a back channel operation, so to speak. There was a new guerrilla force that had been developed to do special operations. It was called Delta Force.
Mm-hmm.
And the man who was the guiding genius of it all was Charlie Beckwith, mm-hmm. Colonel Beckwith,
I believe,
he was at the time. Later on, he appeared on this radio program.
Is that right?
After the operation failed. But let's talk about Charlie Beckwith and what he was up to.
Sure. Charlie Beckwith was a former Army Ranger and Special Forces soldier who had participated in an officer exchange program to go to the British SAS for a certain amount of time. And he was blown away by the SAS. I believe SAS stands for Special Air Squadron. But U.S. Special Forces units are very free with their praise of the U.K. SAS as being really the modern founders of just the concept of special operations, because
they made their big impression in Malaya, I think.
That's right.
Or Malaysia, as it was called then.
Yeah. And they were an offshoot of units in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that they differed from the Green Berets, which was the United States version, was the Green Berets specialized in training and consultation with guerrilla groups involved in overthrowing communist and fascist dictatorships around the world. That was their whole reason for being. But the Green Berets, I mean, obviously there were soldiers and they would participate in military, you know, battles, but they were not, they were there primarily as advisors and teachers and trainers for indigenous groups. They weren't designed to be direct kinetic attackers.
But SAS was out in the field blowing up and killing.
Exactly. But they were also very much a hearts and minds organization, yeah. And they were the foundation of modern counterterrorism and counterinsurgency theory to this day. So Colonel Beckwith came back from his training with the SAS, and he said, Special Forces, U.S. Special Forces, the Green Berets are great, but we need something like SAS. We need behind enemy lines, covert operations that can blow stuff up and kill.
And they commissioned him to go ahead and do that, and he took some 2 years to develop that force. And then somebody told President Carter, hey, we've got this stuff in reserve. This is maybe what we have to do to get our people out of Tehran.
Right. And so Delta Force had been trained up for about 2 years. They hadn't had an assignment and they hadn't had anything to do. And in November of 1979 was when the hostages were taken hostage. Colonel Beckwith was told almost immediately to start preparing a plan. Colonel Beckwith didn't think that they would ever be called up for this particular rescue mission because it just seemed so crazy that they were going to fly into Tehran, try to take down a hostile building, liberate 66.
So he didn't develop the plan. Who did develop the plan? Do we know?
No, he developed it. I mean, he did what he was asked to do, which was to come up with a plan.
Use your force to get our people out of Tehran. You developed the plan.
Right. I mean, he still thought that the whole idea was kind of crazy. Uh-huh. He quoted in his book somebody, one of his men, who said, this is just like the Alamo, but Davy Crockett didn't have to fight his way in, too.
Yes.
So, you know, he was a soldier. He was going to formulate the best plan he could, mm-hmm. although he thought it was kind of crazy. So the plan that he formulated was, I mean, it's so complex, we could spend the entire show on it. But in a nutshell, 8 helicopters were going to fly into Iraq from an aircraft carrier, while 6 U.S. Air Force transport planes were going to fly in from another base, I believe, somewhere like Oman. They were going to rendezvous in the desert of 100 miles out from Tehran overnight in the desert. Then the helicopters would then fly the Delta Force operators even closer to Tehran, where they'd be picked up by the CIA, trucked into Iran proper. Then they were going to cut the power grid, take down the embassy, liberate the Americans, get picked up by the helicopters, taken to another airbase, and then flown out. Now, unfortunately,
Murphy's Law really applies. If anything can go wrong, it will.
Yeah, and I mean, unfortunately and tragically, the whole plan failed in phase one. Yeah. The U.S. Marine Corps pilots that flew these Sea Stallion helicopters, which were never, you know, they're minesweeping helicopters. They were never really designed to fly over land at night, silently and quickly, the way that they were being asked to do. They were caught in a dust storm. And so three of the helicopters turned back, and 5 of them landed in the desert at the rendezvous point. And 6 helicopters had been deemed the minimum number of helicopters required to proceed with the mission. So Colonel Beckwith, you know, through whatever channels he needed to, was relayed all the way back to President Carter that he wanted to abort the mission, and President Carter allowed him to abort the mission while they were preparing for the evacuation. Just to go, everybody was standing down. We're going back. The planes are going back. The helicopters are going back. One of the remaining helicopters clipped the nose or the wing of one of the transport planes. Both exploded into a fireball. 8 U.S. service members were killed. Both aircraft were destroyed in place, and the rest evacuated on the rest of the helicopters and the transport planes.
And one wonders what effect that had on further special operations. We're about to pause, overdue for some commercials. Let's talk about the consequence of that great failure upon all that happened beyond that time.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So the attempt to rescue the hostages in Tehran, Operation Eagle Claw, it was called, mm-hmm. turned out to be an eagle that had no claws at all.
Mm. Yeah.
A terrible failure. What was the consequence of that with regard to actual special operations planning?
Well, I think that Operation Eagle Claw, it is difficult to overstate the importance of Operation Eagle Claw in impacting all modern thinking about what special operations is and how it operates. It was such a debacle. It was such a humiliation, and it exposed such deep dysfunctions within the militaries as they were trying to stand up these anti-terrorism special operations forces that the military and the government got much more serious about fixing some of the deeply ingrained dysfunctions. The most deeply ingrained dysfunction was inter-service rivalries, that there was every branch of the military had to be represented in this operation because, you know, the Navy needed some of their guys in it, and the Marines needed some of their guys, and the Air Force needed some of their guys, based on pride, and because everybody wanted a piece of the action, that was what was actually good for the mission. So in 1986, I believe, the Goldwater-Nichols Act finally established the idea of a Joint Special Operations Command and gave the Joint Special Operations Commander independence and authority and autonomy to act independently of any one of the branches. So now you've got Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 and the 24th Air Force Special Tactics Squadron and certain other intelligence agency, military intelligence agencies, all grouped under one command, answering to one supreme commander.
It's JSOC.
It's JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, which exists to this day. And so the notion of interoperability and one commander where the buck stops on his desk and not the Army Chief of Staff and the Marine Chief of Staff and the Navy Chief of Staff, it's very hard to overstate how important that development was and why current special operations forces work well together. You don't, anywhere that you see a SEAL Team 6 or a Delta Force unit, there will probably be a 24th Special Tactics Squadron's Air Force Command Controller and Parajumper Rescue, because that's what they're good at.
So there's a kind of division of labor, is there?
Absolutely. Well,
how does that work?
SEAL Team 6 has a particular speciality in maritime-based operations. The Special Tactics and Special Tactics Squadron Air Force guys, they specialize in either pararescue, they're called PJs, pararescue jumpers, and also for advance air traffic control, setting down beacons, landing zones, and bombing sites. Delta Force is focused primarily on, more land-based.
How is it then that it was not Delta Force, but rather SEAL Team 6 that did the Osama bin Laden operation?
Well, that's a great question. I think because of the past decade where we fought these wars in pretty much landlocked countries, mm-hmm. SEAL Team 6 has been asked to become experts in more than just maritime operations. One of the other big advancements that happened in the aftermath of Operation Eagle Claw was it was very clear that the pilots, both the Air Force pilots and the Marine pilots, were not trained to do what they were asked to do. And so one of the outcomes was the creation of what's now known as the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, or the Night Stalkers. And this is an entire helicopter brigade, and their whole reason for being is to do the kind of flying that Special Operations Forces need.
There is one other great disaster, and here we've got a sound clip which conveys it. I talk, of course, about what happened at Mogadishu. What was the date of that?
That was in, I believe, 1993.
And here it is.
Another thin green line of Americans walked into Mogadishu today, accompanied by new tanks and fighting vehicles and helicopters, walked into a country where peace has suddenly broken out. Hardly a shot has been fired for 4 days now, an indication of just how totally General Idid calls the shots. Veterans of the Mogadishu campaign, veterans of the massacre 8 days ago, had a message for the new arrivals. Idid may have called a ceasefire, but watch your backs.
it's kind of giving everybody a false sense of security. Even when we're out on the road, you know, I'm trying to tell the guys, you know, hey, you got to keep watching because you don't know when or how or what's going to happen.
There's still enormous resentment among Somalis. This one hospital took in 300 wounded people 8 days ago, many of them women and children. But people here know it was the American casualty that drove President Clinton in 6 months. Another victory for the wanted warlord named ID.
Actually, it has created more popularity for our leader, the beloved general.
ID.
An American flag was hoisted on Mogadishu's main street today, a banner of ID's new policy. For the general now, peace is the road to power. American diplomats were already talking to his people. All he has to do is survive.
General ID has won this round and quite possibly the war. The UN is still calling him a wanted man, but the U.S. is clearly calling off the chase, which means that Ideed will most probably be here when the Americans are gone. Bob Simon, CBS News, Mogadishu.
So that's a few days after the terrible massacre. Mm-hmm. But in that massacre, the well-known Black Hawk Down incident, they made a whole movie out of it, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
How many men did we lose?
18.
And what happened there?
It was actually not such a failure of a mission. I mean, 18 men was a lot of men to lose, but it was a mission that was designed to capture two of ID's primary lieutenants, and they were, in fact, captured. The thing that set it all off was one of the ranger units that was sent in support of the actual capture and takedown of two of ID's lieutenants. His rappelling line, he slipped and he fell 70 feet out of a helicopter, and so he was an injured man. The entire mission somewhat broke down from there. They still captured the men that they were supposed to capture, but in trying to rescue the man who was down, one of the helicopters was shot down. And then it became a double rescue effort. Some of the Delta Force members who were supposed to be just snipers and in support asked to go in and to protect some of the men that were down. And that's Shugart and Gordon, who are, I believe, they posthumously got the Medal of Honor in truly an Alamo-style last stand as they were being surrounded by literally hundreds of Somali hostiles. They killed, must have been dozens upon dozens of Somalis who were bearing down on them before they were overtaken. So there's a lot of factors in which the Black Hawk Down incident was not quite the failure that it was that history has consigned it to. I don't think it really helped the judgment of history. Doesn't really help that President Clinton in fact pulled forces out. You know, within a couple
have we covered
days.
All of the failures? Have all the rest been successes or more or less draws?
I'm sure there's a lot of failures we don't know about.
But in terms of losing men and losing.
There were a couple of incidents in the Panama invasion where some SEAL members drowned for reasons that they didn't need to. They bailed out of a helicopter and they miscalculated how heavy their packs were. So that was actually a training failure. Major failures. I think the really iconic ones. I mean, the ones that make the history books, the ones that are used to teach lessons about what's going right or what's going wrong. I think we've hit the major ones.
A basic question necessarily arises. These are very specially trained guys. They're very, very brave and undoubtedly very, very competent. They seem to be well commanded. Mm-hmm. And this is, I guess, the way you fight modern war, or it's one of the major techniques involved in modern war. Why haven't we? I raise this question just as we're about to sneak away for a newscast, but I want to pursue it directly thereafter. Why haven't we done better in Iraq and, for that matter, in Afghanistan? Iraq, it seems to me, remains very unstable. With our withdrawal, the whole thing may come apart, and Iran may ultimately control Iraq. And in Afghanistan, we're now saying we're going to deal with the Taliban. We have not been able to expunge them from the Afghani scene. So obviously, whatever techniques we're using, including these special ops, aren't producing absolutely maximum desired effects. Why not, is the question. Directly back to Jim Frederick in pursuit of that particular issue. After an update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Jim Frederick, who is, by the way, a local boy. That is true, isn't it?
I'm from Libertyville, yeah.
From Libertyville originally. But you've been with Time Magazine for quite a while.
Since 2002, mm-hmm. Yes.
Your training was at Columbia University, not one of the locals.
No, I studied English literature at Columbia. Mm-hmm. I went there when I was 18 years old and stayed in New York for 12 years. And then Time moved me. I was Tokyo bureau chief for 4 years. And then I worked as a senior editor in London for 2 years. And then I took 2 years to write another military book, called Black Hearts, which is mm-hmm. about a company of soldiers in Iraq's Triangle of Death in 2005 and 2006. And then I came back to New York to run Time.com as executive editor, and now I'm the editor of the international editions.
And in the process, you've also taken time to do this book, Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors. It is a fascinating volume. Hmm. And I want to persist with the question I posed a moment ago. If they are so valuable, if they work so well, why haven't we won our two rather extended wars in the Middle East?
That's a great question. That's a million-dollar question. I think the easiest answer is that special operations forces, by their very nature, and it's in their name, is they are special by definition, which means they are small by definition, which means they are supposed to be just one part or complement of a broader military apparatus and also a broader military structure. So tactically, they're incredibly lethal and day to day, week to week, they're incredibly effective and have been getting more effective all the time because they've been refining their tactics and their day to day operations. But playing whack-a-mole with bad guys and going in and picking them off one by one, even though the work that they do is heroic and valuable and keeps the enemy at bay, I don't think it's really a strategy for holding down massive countries, winning the hearts and minds of, you know, I think there's the population of Iraq is 30 million, 35 million at this point, and, you know, is one of the major powers of the Middle East, and Afghanistan is... It's not really a way to win a war. And so I think without a broader, more coherent strategy for what exactly we're trying to achieve there, is it nation building or is it, do we just want a nominally friendly ally that is not a safe harbor for Al-Qaeda? I'm not really sure. I mean, just in the past 2 years, I think we've flip-flopped on what our aims are in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
We've reduced those aims.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've backed away.
Right, yeah. I mean, there was a time when we would never talk to the Taliban, and now we're talking about talking to the Taliban. Yeah. And there was a time when, you know, we were going to rebuild Iraq into one of the great democracies of the Middle East. But
through both of those wars, you say that just about every night our special ops were out there capturing and or killing a targeted enemy.
Sure, yeah, definitely. Unquestionably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were some of the major operations? Some of the ones we maybe don't know enough about, but who did we knock off?
In 2005 or 2006, we killed Zarqawi, who was the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq,
right,
and was a rather notorious troublemaker, in the most understated use of the word troublemaker. A real murderous thug mm-hmm. who specialized in gigantic car bombs and killed thousands of people. We tracked him all over the Triangle of Death, southern and northern Iraq, and finally through signal intelligence, tracked him via a car of his spiritual advisor to a small town just north of Baghdad called Hibhib, I think. And Delta Force units moved in, and they were concerned that that after years and years of near misses, once they had eyeball lock on him as he was driving past a checkpoint, was one of the more frustrating stories that I heard about him slipping away. So they didn't want him to slip away again. So rather than go in with a Delta Force component that was too small to get the job done, they called in an airstrike, and two 500-pound bombs were dropped on him. And 500-pound bombs are very, very big bombs. And he was killed on the scene.
The capture of Saddam Hussein apparently had special ops aspects, but that wasn't advertised at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a much smaller and less known branch of JSOC called the Intelligence Support Activity, mm-hmm. which is a U.S. Army branch, was designed to be basically the CIA for the military back in the bad old days when the military and the CIA didn't work very well together. So there was a guy by the name of Colonel King who basically created a military CIA, and they still exist to this day, and they're known as the Intelligence Support Activity, or just simply the Activity. They're known as the Activity. And so the Activity specializes in signal intelligence, and they were instrumental in hunting down Saddam Hussein through a variety of cell phone triangulations. And also, they're not just knob turners, as the phrase goes, but they're also involved in on-the-ground kinetic activities. So they would capture or help Delta and SEAL Team 6 capture some of his lieutenants.
But apparently, in a way, the killing operation has shifted from squads of that sort to drone assaults.
Mm.
This fellow Aulaki,
yeah,
an American citizen killed by us,
yeah,
and properly killed, I would say, and killed in Yemen.
Right.
He was done in by drones.
Yeah.
The Israelis use drone-like rockets to get some of their people in Hamas.
That's right, yeah. No, that's really the next, I mean, maybe the next book that I write will be about the next chapter of this kind of warfare that is really moving to drone-based technologies,
yeah,
which has its own ethical and legal implications. Because one of the things that we haven't touched on is, you know, we're all, you know, America's toughest warriors, but there's some real troubling ethical and legal.
Well, you can kill innocents.
Yeah, well, you can kill innocents, yeah. And also, you know, the military to a great degree has turned into, you know, a bunch of hit squads. And are we okay with that? Seems to be that we are okay with it, but foreign governments are not necessarily okay with that. And the same goes for drones. I mean, remote technologies killing from thousands of miles away, where a lot of the pilots of these drones are sitting in Las Vegas. I'm volunteering is that there's some thorny legal and ethical issues fighting wars this way.
You got me with that line just now. Some of the pilots are sitting in Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's right. They're launched.
Las Vegas particularly.
Yeah, yeah. What's the base there? Nellis Air Force Base. Yeah, that's where one of the main drone squadrons are located. So they're the literal drone is launched out of Jalalabad or wherever, but the pilot is sitting in Las Vegas, Nevada at Nellis Air Force Base.
Controlling through full video that he has on the
full
drone.
Video feed, you know, wide band, wide area network, his crystal clear readout, but those pilots are very often not even in Afghanistan or Kuwait. They're in America.
As a psychologist, inevitably, I wonder what the consequences are for long-term consequences for the participants, whether the guys on the ground who blow up the doors and kill people or whether the guys back in Las Vegas. But if you're engaged in this sort of stuff and some innocents inevitably are going to be hit. What are the long-range consequences for these people? Is there psychological burnout as well as physical exhaustion?
There really is. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of the research that I and Time have done on special operations forces is the United States Army in the post-Vietnam era, conventional forces, big army, you know, infantry and armor, has been much more mature and realistic about the long-term negative effects of prolonged combat, PTSD and whatnot. And this acknowledgement that, you know, soldiers are not supermen and they can only do this so long before there's significant negative impact on their psychologies. I think that the special operations universe is much slower to an acknowledgement and acceptance of this fact. I think that even though we talked about their disposition of calm, understated excellence and glory aversion, there's also a perception that they can take anything and keep taking anything, and that they
can't be true.
Yeah, that they are impervious to these kinds of things, that they, in fact, are mentally tougher than most soldiers. And I think the negative impacts psychologically are going to be amplified rather than minimized. Through this, they just don't seem to be anywhere near the acceptance that this is a problem or this is normal, that psychological degradation over prolonged warfare is in fact a normal human response and that that's okay. And I think we also talked about some of special operations soldiers who speak out, they're very often ostracized by their who write books or, you know, become public. They're ostracized by their old communities because, you know, because of this glory avoidance ethos. But a lot of them say that they're just trying to speak out. I mean, Henry Wasden, who wrote SEAL Team 6, I mean, when we interviewed him, he said that the whole reason that he was writing a book, and a very successful book at that, and, you know, was being called to account, well, you know, did you sell out your Navy SEALness? He said, the whole second half of his book is about his struggles with PTSD and that he wanted to break the silence, that this is a problem, and that, you know, these super warriors are in fact not supermen.
Life is complicated, and it's possible that no wars are ever fully won also.
Yeah.
It's time for us to pause, but before that, it's time to invite telephone calls. We've got the lines open at this instant. The number, of course, is 312-591-7200. Any question you want to raise? For that matter, if you've got military background and have some opinions or experience you want to share, you're more than welcome. 312-591-7200 is the number. Please get those calls in quickly. We hope to go to them directly after the coming commercials. Also, for those overseas listeners and others at great distance who are listening to us via the Internet, the best way for you to reach us is by email, the email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Though lately we've had a few overseas calls directly at 312-591-7200. So if you're listening on the Pacific Rim and want to pick up the phone, that's fine. Or we had a call the other night from somebody in Dusseldorf in Germany. If you're up that early and want to call us, if you got Skype, you could do it with at no great cost to yourself. 312-591-7200, whether by if you're not using email, if you are using email, do so. If not, wherever you are, 312-591-7200. Get those calls in quickly. We'll be with you right after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly to the phones for your questions and comments to Jim Frederick, author of Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors. 312-591-7200 is, of course, the number. And first up is Bob. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Little background. I'm a Vietnam combat vet and a PTSD sufferer. And I wanted to ask your correspondent if the returning special forces operators are experiencing the same level of suicides upon returning home that unfortunately our Iraqi veterans have experienced?
That's a great question. I'm not aware of any statistics that I know of on suicide specifically, but yeah, we were just discussing that they're almost certainly experiencing problems with PTSD at a rate commensurate with the rest of the broader, you know, infantry and frontline combat units are experiencing coming back from Iraq. And I think that this is a public health and a public policy problem that I don't think that the Army or the government or even broader American society has really begun to deal with.
We should make clear what PTSD means.
Oh, it's
post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, that's right. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I think that the special operations community continues to operate under a misperception that they're somehow impervious to some of the corrosive effects of long-term combat. And I think that they are coming back with significant psychological health issues that are not necessarily being addressed.
One other question, if I can. Have you seen the reality shows that show the training for the SEALs, BUDS training, and the pararescue? Really, really extreme training, almost to the point where you're expected to go unconscious or allow yourself to practically drown without ever giving up. It seems that kind of mentality would lead you or keep you from seeking any help if you need it.
You know, that's a good point, and I'm not sure that that connection is being drawn often enough? Because, yeah, I'm certainly familiar with the training. I mean, I never served, so I never had to undergo it, but I researched it enough to know that the training, you know, the training specialists, the pedagogical departments that design the training, they've been doing this so long that they're really pretty good at inducing hallucinations through sleep deprivation. And a lot of these guys who go through ranger training or, you know, buds training, you know, they're losing 40 and 50 pounds in just a couple of weeks.
Sir, we thank you for the call, and we'll go quickly to another. But that just further underlines what we were talking about before we went to that first call. There's a lot of stress there, and there are psychological costs that are going to be paid sooner or later.
Absolutely.
312-591-7200. We've now got a few lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, try again quickly, and we go next to Kurt. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening. I wanted to discuss a Delta Force operation that occurred, I believe, in either late November or sometime in December 2001. In Dalton Fury's book, Kill Bin Laden, he had mentioned that they had operational intel that Bin Laden was somewhere fleeing Tora Bora to go toward the Pakistan border, and they had requested that the escape route be mined via cluster bombs, and I guess Delta Force wanted to come up from the AFPAC border from the south and squeeze them between Tora Bora and the border. And the National Defense Command, being Rumsfeld and George W. Bush, denied it. And that was the only time that it was ever a Delta Force request was ever denied, even though George W. Bush had said, you know, we'll smoke them out of the holes, wanted dead or alive. Do you have any stories, background stories that you've heard from other Delta Force operators about this particular mission that didn't occur?
Unfortunately, I don't. I mean, I do know about the account in Dalton Fury's book, and I do know that there's a lot of questions and vagueness around why the mission was or was not called off. And I know that Dalton Fury has a particular, very particular point of view on this. And if memory serves, it's a particularly impassioned passage from his book. I can't really speak to whether or not even he necessarily has his facts correct. I'm not saying he doesn't. I'm just saying that I don't particularly know myself.
Did you hear another story that the British SAS, the SAS, 22 SAS to be exact, had come close to capturing Bin Laden sometime around the Tora Bora attacks, and they were called off because they wanted the Americans to either kill or capture Bin Laden and not the British?
No, I hadn't heard that, although I had heard that Saddam Hussein in the spider hole was well within the grasp of SAS, could have gotten there first, but they were called off because the 4th Infantry Division had to come in and do it. But I hadn't heard the SAS story, but I'm not particularly surprised. These things do happen.
And how does JSOC feel about such incidents?
Well, I couldn't speak for JSOC itself.
What about some of the, maybe, you know, commanders that they have that have been on the record about such, like, obvious, you know, incompetence? You know, enemy is enemy. Who cares who gets them?
Yeah, I mean, taking it away a little bit from directly special operations units and some of the work that I've done just with Maine and conventional infantry units, just stories abound for things getting in the way of killing bad guys because, you know, either that unit was there first or there's a question about whether or not, you know, there's high tension power lines in the way. And I mean, there's all kinds of.
Wasn't there an occasion way back during the Clinton administration when we had targeted Osama bin Laden and he called off an attack upon him?
I think that there was some question about whether or not there was there could have been a Delta or SEAL dispatch mission, but Clinton elected to do Hellfire missiles instead. I don't know if there was one more other than that one, but I do know.
I guess that's the one I have in mind.
Yeah,
they went with missiles from a distance rather than troops on the ground.
Right. Yeah. I think that the commanders were in favor of doing a mission like the one that killed Osama bin Laden this time, but Clinton elected to do a long-range missile attack.
And I elect necessarily to pause for an update on the evening's news in just a moment after I say that we've now got some lines available again at 312-591-7200. 7200. We've had some calls from rather experienced gentlemen who've, I think, surely one has been a special forces kind of person, or at least a Delta Force. What did he say he was? Green Beret, I guess. And the other one sounded quite knowledgeable. If you're equally knowledgeable and have something to contribute, get in there quickly. If you're as naive as I am, but have an interesting question, by all means, get in there as well. 312-591-7200. And if you want to get to us via email, that address is extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And with that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guest tonight has been and continues to be till midnight, Jim Frederick, who is these days the editor of Time International. He's the former managing editor of Time Digital, and he's got lots of time. And we're going to go directly, and we've got lots of time. That's, we've got about 25 minutes left. And we go directly back to the phones. And we hope for a few more good calls. We've got some lined up, but there's room still for more. My friends should get in there right now with some overarching question that raises issues concerning how, what kind of military posture we should be maintaining as we go on through this new century. 312-591-7200, and Tom is our next caller. Good evening, sir.
Hey, Mel, thanks for having me on. Love your show. Hey, a little background on myself. I served in the 75th Ranger Regiment and 3rd Ranger Battalion as a sniper. I did three tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan, all under the umbrella of JSOC.
My goodness. You're one of the guys we're talking about.
So a couple of comments I wanted to make. I've been listening to your whole show. Great show. You started out talking about Thermopylae. I'd argue that the first Special Forces mentioned would be David's Mighty Men, but that's not really important. Another thing, your guest mentioned a number of about 60,000 Special Operations Forces and about 4,000 what we would refer to as Tier 1 operators. I think it's important to distinguish there that there's, if you say Green Berets, there's the Green Berets who are going out on missions and doing their actual job, and there's also members of the unit who are, you know, handing out uniforms, cooking the food, who get lumped into that number. So if you look at the direct action side of it, that number is going to be much, much lower than the number he mentioned. You are also asking about why the SEAL Team 6 was chosen to take out Osama bin Laden rather than other units. And Admiral McCraven is currently in charge of JSOC, and being a former Navy SEAL himself and part of the Navy, when that decision came up, it was a pretty clear-cut choice for him to choose his alma mater, if you will, and give that mission to the SEALs. So I think that it's pretty clear that that's, that was the process that happened there. Let's see, you asked for a couple failure missions that were failures. There's a gentleman, I don't know if you had him on your program or not, I believe his name is Marcus Luttrell, who his entire team was killed, I believe, and he was he has a book, I believe it's called Lone Survivor, and I think that's an excellent example where
helicopter that was shot down.
Yeah, and his basically most of them died. They ended up being rescued by Rangers, but I think that's a great great example of that.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that there aren't a plethora of failures that we can point to speaks to the effectiveness of the Special Operations Forces. And you've been talking about the PTSD issue, and I would disagree with your guess. The level of training and screening that goes on to select the operators is very difficult to even describe. I mean, you're talking about years and years and just a select handful of men. And these guys literally are, I mean, I can't even describe you how... what caliber of...
So you're saying that on the basis of selection procedures, they get a bunch of tough guys who are going to withstand all the psychological pressures.
Yes.
Let's get some comment. You've said a number of very interesting things. Let's hear some reaction from Jim Frederick.
You know, great comments. Thank you for listening. It's all really interesting and informative stuff. Yeah, I would agree that the numbers for the regular special operations forces and the JSOC forces do include support personnel. So the frontline operators are far lower. The Marcus Luttrell book is, in fact, excellent. I don't know if that was the mission that was at Tora Bora or not. About the PTSD thing, I remain committed to the notion that no matter how hardcore these guys are, they're still human beings, and one can only withstand so much high-intensity combat before there being a long-run impact. And you know, if you're correct, that's great. These guys will be less of a tax on the American taxpayer and the healthcare system. One of the things that I'm most interested now is writing stories and doing research on the Veterans Administration system and, the psychological health and welfare system of all veterans who are coming back. And, when I write stories and when I do research, I really don't think, whether they're special operators or not, I don't think that the American public is really prepared for the generation, the level of public expenditure and public policy that we're going to have to go through as a nation to take care of a lot of these veterans that are coming back, no matter what division or regiment they're from.
Another thing I wanted to mention, a good example of kind of in the same time frame as the Desert One, where basically JSOC was formed, is Entebbe, which is, I'm sure, Milt, you're familiar with that operation, but almost a exact opposite as far as planning and execution, and really a blueprint of what a good special operations mission looks like.
Well, we have lots of interesting special ops operations done by other military forces. Certainly, the Entebbe rescue, there were over 100 people who had been... their plane had been commandeered by, I forget which particular Arab terrorist group, and there they were in Uganda in the airport, and they were rescued by a bunch of Israeli soldiers who flew in. The only one who was killed in that whole operation was the brother of the current Prime Minister of Israel.
Yeah, we haven't really talked, except for the British, about other international special operations forces. And obviously the Israelis are best in class, and the Germans actually have a really outstanding special operations group. So there's quite a few countries that are actually quite good at this.
Our thanks, sir. Thank you very much for joining us.
No, your last caller mentioned Dalton Fury. Just one more thing.
All right.
A lot of these people who write books are literally, it's hard to describe the level of ostracization that happens in the community when they do that, and they are... shunned would be a light word.
And you've been shunning some of them yourself, I gather.
Yeah, a lot of them aren't given a lot of any credibility once they do that.
Well, that's interesting. Thanks again for the call.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Good night. This guy's been through it all.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you raised great points, for sure.
We're going to pause. A last quick round of commercials, then right back to the phones on 312-591-7200. I'm looking for some good email that hasn't yet come in. Where are my friends in... on the Pacific Rim. I want to hear from some of them tonight. Extension 720 at WGNradio.com.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we'll go directly back to the phones for your questions and comments to Jim Frederick, author of the book that is the basis of our discussion tonight, Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors. That's published by Time Magazine itself. 312-591-7200. And next up is Frederick. You are on the air, sir. Good evening.
Oh, good evening, Milt. Love your show. Can't wait to grab this book. Okay. My question is this. There's a service group of guys, big, big bravado, the United States Marines. They have a section of them called Reconnaissance Rangers. And how do they compare... special forces guys, SEALs, and what kind of scuttlebutt have you heard about those guys?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, Force Recon Marines, I mean, the Marines would tell you that they're, you know, as good as any special operations force, period. And yes, Force Recon Marines are the best of the Marines' best. And so, yeah, I would say that Force Recon Marines should definitely be considered a special operations group. In fact, I think that there was traditionally no Marine Special Operations Command. It got formed, I think, just a couple of years ago. And Force Recon Marines, I believe, you know, if Marines out there active duty, they certainly will correct me as soon as I say this if I'm incorrect. But I think they've been reclassified. Force Recon Marines have been reclassified as under the newly formed Marine Special Operations Command, MARSOC.
Okay, and you're saying what they do is they just kind of poop and scoop, take a picture here. This surveillance for the most part, right?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that Force Recon Marines, you know, are tip of the sphere, advanced, you know, kinetic combat Marines.
Okay, wow. All right, thanks a lot. I love this book.
Sure. Well, thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. And next up is John. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. I was wondering if your guest is familiar with Dr. David Kilcullen and his books on counterinsurgency and what his opinion is of his strategies. He's supposedly the right arm of Petraeus' strategy in Afghanistan.
I'm very familiar with him. I've never actually met him myself, but read his books and read his writings. And, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, he's been, essential in the formation of modern counterinsurgency theory and practice, and yeah, has been very influential on General David Petraeus. I think just some of his concepts, which go back all the way to, you know, research of the SAS in the Malaya emergency and Malaysia at the time, you know, I think a lot of his ideas are now thought of as fundamental bedrock concepts of modern counterinsurgency, you know, going all the way to, you know, hearts and minds, and focusing on the people are the prize, not the playing field, and concepts like that.
That's the answer, sir. Thank you very much for the call. There's another matter, not exactly in the bailiwick that we've been traipsing around in, but still related. Well, it has to do, in fact, with the behavior of soldiers in this case in Afghanistan, I guess. And I want to read this to you. You'll recognize this instantly. Mm-hmm. Representative Alan West, Republican, Florida, a former Army Lieutenant Colonel, sends the Weekly Standard an email comment on the Marines video. These were Marines, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And has given us permission to publish it. And he says, this is Congressman West, "I have sat back and assessed the incident with the video of our Marines urinating on Taliban corpses. I do not recall any self-righteous indignation when our Delta snipers Shugart and Gordon had their bodies dragged through Mogadishu. Neither do I recall media outrage and condemnation of our Blackwater security contractors being killed, their bodies burned and hung from a bridge in Fallujah. All these over-emotional pundits and armchair quarterbacks need to chill. Does anyone remember the two soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division who were beheaded and gutted in Iraq? The Marines were wrong. Give them a maximum punishment under field grade level, Article 15, paren nonjudicial punishment. Place a general officer level letter of reprimand in their personnel file and have them in full dress uniform stand before their battalion, each personally apologize to God, country, and Corps, videotaped, and conclude by singing the full U.S. Marine Corps hymn without a teleprompter. As for everyone else, unless you've been shot at by the Taliban, shut your mouth. War is hell." How does that grab you?
Well, let's see. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, he's picked out a sort of nameless, faceless enemy of the, you know, the mainstream media. I'm not sure there's all that much righteous indignation. I mean, they broke a rule under the UCMJ that you're not to desecrate corpses. I'm not really sure that anybody is saying that anything much more should happen to them than what is under the UCMJ and whatever the maximum punishment allowable under the UCMJ. But the comparison with, you know, insurgents or, you know, Somali citizens or, you know, irregular forces is not a particularly apt one. These are American Marines, and they are not just expected to act in a certain way. And the war is hell argument doesn't get you very far, because we do now live in a world where, you know, one soldier, one Marine with a misplaced shot and a misplaced rifle or committing a crime can stir up, you know, the propaganda value of that is immeasurable. And so it's not so much for the impact that that video or those photos have had on, you know, United States public opinion. It's the impact that those images have around the world. And it's the reality that we live in. If those things have happened in warfare since time immemorial, they haven't flown around the world in literally seconds the way that they can now. And so in my previous book, Black Hearts, I wrote in the foreword that soldiers and Marines and frontline, you know, operations forces are required to be nothing less than warrior monks. That's as it has to be, just because every single local and every single locale that American forces are fighting in has a cell phone with a camera in it. And they can send those images around the world instantaneously. And the propaganda value of those images is just too high. It's just how it's got to be. The soldiers and these Marines can't do that. It's bad for America, period.
So the nature of war may have changed, basically. You now win not merely by brute force and by intelligent operations, but also by proper comportment.
It's an info war. It's also an info war. It absolutely is. And so, you know, whoever that elected official is has got the wrong side of the argument. It's not the righteous indignation of some nameless, faceless mainstream media. It's the fact that not only are we fighting kinetic wars, we're fighting info wars. And soldiers and Marines who do that, and they've done that since war is hell, and atrocities have always been committed, and the very nature of warfare is to dehumanize the enemy. That's the only way that soldiers and Marines can kill other people, but you can't desecrate corpses because the propaganda value is just too high.
Yeah. Well, you say whoever this commentator is, it is Representative Alan West, who is Republican from Florida, and also a former military, former lieutenant colonel in the Army. He's also a black guy. And he's outstanding in that he's been, more than just about any other, as much as any other member of Congress, he's been very denunciatory towards Islam generally and towards Islamic fundamentalist, militarist organizations. And what he's making mention of are the desecrations of American bodies. Three such incidents are in this one little statement that he sent to one of the conservative magazines.
But that's an invalid comparison, because do we not come from a standpoint where we, by definition...
We're not them.
We're not
sure.
Them. Yeah. I mean, so that doesn't really get us very far, because American fighting forces are not supposed to do that. They're just not supposed to. I mean, it just couldn't be clearer. And it's kind of where it ends.
You are sort of a persisting student of American military operations.
I am, yeah. I never served. I don't know. It's just sort of happened accidentally. I followed stories that interested me,
but
got me into the military.
We may be at the beginning of yet another change in the very nature of our forces, and ultimately how we fight wars and what kind of wars we will fight. We've just had the announcement from the administration of a very considerable reduction in military expenditure.
Right.
And we know that we're going increasingly, maybe even replacing the kinds of people you've been writing about, we're going increasingly to drone assaults upon targeted persons.
Yeah, I think that's the big next generation in warfare, and I think it's a fascinating, fascinating topic. And it, you know, it just opens up all kinds of new avenues of ethical and legal concerns. Warfighting potency. The drone program in Afghanistan has been very, very successful by many counts. But there is something to the long distance, long range bombing of it. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, we special operations forces, there's no kind of killing that's more intimate than, you know, a small group of men who take down a house and put two bullets into Osama bin Laden at point blank range. It's a very, very different kind of warfare when drones circulating 15,000 miles overhead in Afghanistan are actually being piloted by technicians in Las Vegas, Nellis Air Force Base. I mean, it's just sort of extraordinary how the two most common forms of modern warfare in that level of intimate killing couldn't be more different.
Shall we work in one more very quick call? We'll try to do that. And here is Tim. Only a minute or so available, sir. Go ahead.
Hello, sir. I just got on the program, and your guest was just saying that he's never been in war. He's never been in the military. I'm just wondering, you know, I know this is a naive question to ask, but I'm just wondering, you know, it sounds to me like you're passing judgment a little bit too much on them without ever having been there yourself.
I haven't heard too much judgment that you've passed so far.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's in the
East. Except you admire the bravery of some of these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would fundamentally disagree with that. If you caught on the tail end about the case of the Marines urinating on corpses, I'm not being judgmental. I'm just saying what's in the UCMJ. It's against the rules. It's kind of the end of the story.
UCMJ is
Universal
Code of Military Justice.
We
are approaching the end of the available time. This has been fascinating.
I've had a great
conversation
time.
For me. And the book is well worth commendation. Time Magazine's special book titled Special Ops, The Hidden World of America's Toughest Warriors. Jim Frederick, who's been our guest, has been very close in the study of all of this and knows a great deal about it. I note that the introduction to the book is written by Bob Kerry, former senator from Nebraska,
who
was himself very early in his life sort of a special ops guy.
Yeah, he was a Navy SEAL, not SEAL Team 6. SEAL Team 6 didn't...
was formed later.
Yeah, but I mean, make no mistake, quote-unquote regular Navy SEALs are pretty formidable customers no matter what. Mm-hmm. And he was a SEAL Team member in his early days and his early career.
It is my duty now to tell you very quickly what's coming on the program. And tomorrow night, we are looking at the politics of Russia, which seems even possibly more corrupt and surely more dishonest than the politics of the city of Chicago. And a number of Russian experts, former Soviet experts, one might say, will be our guests. And then going on the next night, we're talking about the descent of man, in Darwin's term. That is to say, who preceded us? Did we come from Australopithecus? No. Many more discoveries since then, and what they are will be closed as we talk to two anthropological paleontologists. Thursday night, we talk about the art of political cartooning with Scott Stantis of the Tribune and one or two other fine political cartoonists. It's time to close down shop. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.